And welcome to AFL Tonight. This is ArenaFan.com's weekly look at everything arena football. I'm your host, Tim Capper, along with Adam Markowitz. How are you?
Greetings and salutations.
We have had one hell of a pre-broadcast, haven't we?
10:30 at night, we're just getting started.
I know. I think what we'll probably do is we had an interview, a great interview this week, with a long-time Tampa Bay Storm employee who has been given a great opportunity. And what we're going to do is I think we'll break his interview up into two parts so we can get the gist of it, of what he's been asked to do, and then we'll go along with the Warren I-4 information there. So we'll get to that. Let's see. Pigs in a blanket. we have to talk about, God, what else? Trying to see here. There's stuff to talk about. I mean, obviously, the AFL Hall of Fame selection committee, that was announced this week. I don't know. What the hell's going on with some of these teams, Adam? Some teams seem to be going on the cheap, and it really is disconcerting, especially for fans. You had a very interesting interview today, which we'll talk about slightly. And a lot more. So might as well just go ahead and get right to it. As you said, Adam, busy night, get out the pot of coffee, right?
Yep.
So I think, you know what? Well, let's go ahead and talk about it. You had a great article this week, especially on the Chicago Rush. And you got a lot of positive feedback on it. And real quickly, let's go ahead and mention what the article was about, and we can talk a little bit more about it.
Yeah, I was talking to our Rush beat writer, Jeff Sims, before his Rush played my Predators on Saturday night, and I told him I was actually far more interested in dealing with his team than dealing with my team over the course of the night. And I had the opportunity to go into the Chicago locker room after the game. Of course, they won that game by 8 points in a game where really just about everything that could have gone wrong really did go wrong. They lost Carson Kaufman for a play. Uh-huh. They had a wide receiver ejected. They were down to 16 players at the end of the game. They ended up having Jorik Calvin sent to the hospital. I cannot totally confirm that he's out of the hospital. From what I'm gathering, he at least is in great condition.
Well, he actually tweeted a picture of himself.
Oh, so, did he?
Yes, he did. He did, and he thanked everybody. Obviously, for the well wishes, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a brutal injury for anyone who didn't see it. It's not for the squeamish of heart. It looked nasty live. It looked even nastier on replay. Basically, Calvin went headfirst into the wall while trying to defend a touchdown pass in the first quarter against the Predators. But literally everything went wrong in this game for Chicago. And yet the Rush were still able to pull this one off. And I was very impressed with what I saw from the team, and it's very sad that this is a team that is getting zero help whatsoever from its ownership.
Yeah.
It's to the point that I am going to officially call this team the Rockford Rush from now on, because I don't ever think they're playing a game in Chicago ever again, or in, you know, Rosemont ever again. And Coach McMillan was really – I have met him before, but I never had the opportunity of interviewing him before, and he really is a fantastic guy, and you could tell that he is – doing everything that he can for a team that has just so little to legitimately work with. And look, at this point, the Rush are in first place in the Central Division, and no one is going, you know, you may be able to take a lot of things away from them, but you can't take that away from them.
No, exactly.
And if the team does get the opportunity to play in the playoffs this year, it's not the most talented team in the league by any stretch of the imagination. Carson Kaufman is not a top five quarterback. But this team's got a lot of heart to it, and you can't necessarily measure that. It doesn't necessarily measure out to wins and losses, but it's something that really can make a difference in that close game, in that dire situation when you're on the road and you need to make the play in this league. And that's what Chicago, from what I've been seeing of late, has been able to do. They've been able to make that play because they really do genuinely trust each other. And we know that's not the case in locker rooms all across the country.
No, this team basically has, as I said, everything you lose for, but I will admit they are, you know, I keep picking against them week after week after week for some reason and the pick 'em. And this is a team that is a big surprise. I mean, if they make the playoffs, how far will they go? Where will they play, et cetera? You know, for the Rush itself, it is basically a new beginning starting this week. You know, they basically have packed their bags except for the practice roster, and they're off to Rockford. This is their home for three games. They have they are going to have some following with the Rush fans. We already know that. Could we say Coach McMillan could be a Coach of the Year because of all the issues that he's been going through?
I think he absolutely is Coach
exactly.
of the Year.
Exactly. Hell
I
mean, yes.
No disrespect to Coach Guy and to Coach Ewart or to Coach Moss or any of those guys who've had great teams this year. Mm-hmm. Coach McMillan has done more with less than anyone potentially in the history of this league through 11 games. Now granted, there's still a lot of work to do. There are still some real SOB road games to play. There's an SOB home game that has become a road game at the end of the season.
Yeah.
Everything is out there for the Rush to get, but they are going to have just the toughest road to get there. If they get in the playoffs and McMillan's not the Coach of the Year, something is absolutely wrong.
No, it just seems we are always heading back to the issues that are happening with the with the Chicago Rush organization, and it's they got PR, press releases going out now and stuff like that again, and it's they're coming from the league obviously, but it's what can you say really? I mean, it's been all Chicago. Last year it was so poor when it came to the fans and the labor dispute. This year it's snowballed all over again, Adam, where it's, an issue where the fans in a particular city now are basically getting the shaft. I guess that's the best way of putting it. But who would have thought? I said, the Rush is where they actually are at this time of the year, and playoffs? Possibility. But, it's funny. We can easily graduate here from talking about the Chicago Rush and what has happened to teams going on in the cheap. And, look what happened for 2 weeks in Chicago when it came to not having an internet, or not any replay, no screen, no mics, no et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems that some of the teams that I think we would probably least expect are starting to cut corners a little bit more, and it's fans are beginning to notice.
Yeah, I mean, I threw out the question there today, and there will be an article coming as soon as I have an hour and a half, 2 hours to put it all together, about the game day experience for the fans, and really where this stemmed from a bunch of little things adding up. The first one is from the Rush directly. Obviously, we've all heard the story about their big inflatable helmet that they used to run through before games that aren't there anymore. There's no real pregame pomp and circumstance, no pyro. There's really nothing for the fans for the game day experience aside from the game itself, and that's bad in and of itself. But what really got me with the Rush is that they really have made no effort to accommodate fans, not so much for that game on July 27th that they've lost, but for the game on July 13th that has been moved from Rosemont to Rockford. They're sending out just a generic letter that basically says, here's where you mail your tickets to, and there is no intent at this point to issue refunds for the game or for any other games. And of course, the game they're implying about is the one on July 13th against the Cleveland Gladiators.
Right.
And to me, it was such a Bush League thing to do. And in the article that we spoke about last week, I called for the league or the owners of the Rush, or, however you want to classify it, to refund Rush season ticket holders all of their money for the year for all the crapola that they've had to go through on this campaign. But that's kind of where this started. Then a report surfaced out of Iowa that fans were getting balls taken away,
right,
that they were catching in the stands. And I was in Orlando this week. This is the first time all year they haven't had a house band playing during the game. This is also the first time I haven't been at every single game in team history, but I'll say it's the first time in team history that they didn't have any pyrotechnics.
What?
Before the game. None. Not a single firework got shot off in Orlando. And I posed the question about the game day experience for fans from across the country. Because obviously, you know, here at Arena Fam, we're only a few guys, and Tim doesn't do us much good going to games from Montreal.
You're right.
So, you know, I can only cover so many teams in the state of Florida at one time. And the news has been very mixed. You know, people sort of complain about lack of fireworks in Philadelphia to you know, hearing that things are going great in Arizona and they're going great in San Jose. Uh-huh. And, of course, the comment that I made is, I don't think it's that shocking that there's a correlation here between the fact that those two franchises have put so much into their pregame experience and the game day experience for the fans,
right,
and the fact that they're winning games, because it shows that they're truly committed to their franchises through and through. For the rest of the teams in this league, though, it seems like it's getting worse, and we've seen it with the housing with the players. We've seen it with meals with the players.
Yeah.
The quality of meal, the quantity of meal. You know, we've seen it with salaries, obviously, over the years. You know, the league doing everything that came from behind the scenes, hiring more interns, hiring fewer internal staff members. But when you get down to the bones of it and you get to the actual game day experience to the actual customer, if that's what you are needing to cut back on just to make ends meet or to avoid taking in further losses, this is when it becomes time that you need to not be an owner anymore if that's where you're going, because you are only going to alienate your fan base and make it so no one can ever have kind of a grassroots startup again in your city if you ruin your team.
I don't understand why some of these teams are doing what they are. If it's an issue of money, as you said, you don't need to be an owner. You know, long time franchises like the Predators, you know, not having pyro, not having, I think you said, in-house band, was it in Orlando too, right? No in-house band, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now that was a new thing this year, but to have it for the first three games and then mysteriously in the first, you know, the second home game since the league ended up, essentially since Brett Bushy ended up taking over 1/13th of the Chicago Rush, I find the timing very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Of all of that happening. And it leads me to believe what is going on in this league right now. Is money that tight all of a sudden that the you know, taking over the Rush is putting all these other owners into a situation again where they really do need to take, even if it's a $50 cost-cutting measure, that they're willing to do that, basically damning the fans, you know, damning that game day experience.
Agreed. You know, I know, and it goes to, you know what, if this is happening in Orlando, this makes me wonder, Adam, how much money has gone towards KISS and who is paying for KISS.
It seems very simple who is paying for KISS. It seems like you've got 13 owners.
Yep.
And 13 owners are paying for it, because who else would be paying for it? You know, that's what this single entity thing is. You know, KISS has a lot to do with it. The rent at the Amway Center, I don't know what the rent is at New Orleans Arena, but I'm sure it's higher at the Amway for that game.
Mm-hmm.
They're openly giving away tickets to this Arena Bowl to season ticket holders, basically just so they can say that they've got a crowd, even though I don't think the fans are showing up. I think you're going to see a whole bunch of fans sitting in the upper deck who are going to be brought down into the lower bowl to replace the season ticket holders for Orlando that didn't show up to the game because their team's not going to be in it and all that.
Yeah.
It's getting worse, my friend.
I know. And to me, it's actually, you know, it's damning. It's, you know, to the league, it hurts your fan base. You know, people are so used to having things a certain way. Now, mind you, I've never gone to one of the Alphabet League games, so I don't know what they do as far as pregame stuff. But still, fans are noticing these cost-cutting measures.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I brought up today is all the fans in Chicago who happen to see the Chicago Slaughter games in the, I believe they're in the IFL. I may have the wrong one of those leagues, but I believe it's the IFL that they're in. And everyone is telling me the exact same thing. The Slaughter games are so much better than the Rush games because the Slaughter actually make an effort to help out their fans. I mean, hell, they took post-game interviews off the field at Allstate Arena. They're now in some little hallway or something that they do the post-game interviews in, and based upon what I'm hearing, the vibe of it is basically the only reason that it's being done is because the league says it has to be done, or otherwise it wouldn't be.
I don't know. I wish I could understand sometimes. You know, leagues took over cost-cutting measures.
And I don't want to make it sound like I'm just all doom and gloom on this.
I absolutely understand
that some of the facts that the league is facing.
Right.
The economy is a whole hell of a lot worse now than it was in 2008. I understand that. I understand that when you lower the level of play, you're lowering what you can expect for attendance. You're losing sponsors. I understand that the stream of money is not there. I am just wondering, is it really that bad that the game day experience is suffering? And again, my proposed question that you all will hopefully see by the end of this week is why? Why are we in this situation? If it is that bad, should we really be having an Arena Football League anymore? Or should it be in a situation where whether it's the league needs to go away and someone else needs to take it over and start this up again, or whether it's the league needs to go on another hiatus year? But too many more cost-cutting measures like this are just going to alienate fans to the point that not playing would be better than playing in these crappy little atmospheres.
It makes me wonder, though, if the league did go dark for another year. I know people have said before that it didn't, it wouldn't come back. I think, in all honesty, unless there was really money to bring it back, I don't think the league would return it if the league fails again.
I don't know if the league would return as the AFL, but I still don't think you're killing this game.
No, that's the thing. I mean, the game with the Nets will always be around in some way, shape, or form. It's, going back to you talking about cost-cutting measures, and, I think what it goes to really, and I think we're seeing it more now, sure, the league took over. But if due diligence had been done in the Chicago market with the owners that were there this year, I don't think we'd be having this issue.
Maybe to this extent. I still think that in spite of the fact that we've heard reports that there are multiple other owners or ownership entities that have wanted to buy the Rush, with their own little, caveats thrown in there.
Right.
I don't know if the situation really would have been any better, because the bottom line is you still don't have that much of a fan base to draw from just because of the alienation that's gone on at this point. I don't think there is anyone in the city of Chicago that can save this team right now.
Now, cost-cutting measures, balls going in, I joke and – the league introduced just their first they introduced a green stripe ball this year for their military games. As far as you and I know, most of the teams have had their military games already. They've had their pink balls for Cancer Mother's Day / Mother's Day. Their regular balls. They have the silver stripe balls for last year. I mean, this is money. This is money that's going into the league itself. But do you? All these balls reminds me of the old Pittsburgh Pirates uniforms. Remember back in the 70s where they couldn't decide, it was basically mix and match? Now it's mix and match footballs. Was this money that was really necessary to be spent?
The answer to that is probably because of marketing for some reason. Mm-hmm. A lot goes on behind the scenes that we don't know about.
Yes.
I would also like to throw in one more thing about the balls in the stands that I've been talking about. This started with the story from Iowa, and we have a fan report and we have a team report, and I feel obligated to share them both. There are pockets of fans that say
sure, okay,
that security at the Wells Fargo Center or Arena, the Well, in Des Moines, that security there took balls away from them that went into the stands and that they rightfully ended up with them. The team, I reached out to them and they refuted that by saying that the situation that I'm in specific referring to came from fans who reached out of the stands onto the field who had the footballs taken away. We've got he said, she said, and I don't personally know the facts, but I do want to report both sides of it, of the story from what we've heard from the fans, which caused me to, dig a little bit deeper, to the team. And when I publish the story, this week, both of those sides of this story will be in there.
Okay. Good. Good to hear. Okay. We have the AFL Hall of Fame selection committee was actually brought up this week. Sometimes it could be a bone of contention about who is actually on the list, Adam. And, it's sort of like those lists, the all-time greatest lists. And we had some newbies this year that are actually on the list. The two newbies in particular are Richard Oliver. I don't have the thing in front of me, so I can't remember where he was from.
San Antonio Express.
Thank you. And Jim Robinson, who is the former media director for the Tampa Bay Storm. The other ones are Ed Barkowitz, Troy Clarity, Les Grobstein, Bill Nero, or William Nero, Richard Obert over in Arizona, and Ari Wolf. We all know from the broadcasts. So, I mean, other than from the list itself, I mean, I don't think they have, I guess they do have a lot of work ahead of them. I mean, from what we're seeing, just coming up with some, the first list itself, if you and I were chosen to do it, I'm sure we'd probably differ quite extensively on who we would choose to say as our top five. But these guys have been asked by the league, you know, a great opportunity to do something. I mean, would you like to do this? I never even thought of asking. I mean, would you ask?
Yeah. Sure, I would do this. I feel as though I've got enough history of this league that I would be able to objectively come up with a list of I've heard from a couple of them that they need to come up with up to 10 guys. I don't know whether it is 10 guys or up to 10 guys that they need to put on their list.
Okay.
So yeah, whittling it down to 10 is tough. But yeah, I would absolutely be willing to take that on. Nobody's ever going to ask me, but if they did, I would.
No. I think, was it, our illustrious leader, Joe Coffin, was asked to be a part of, what list was it?
20 greatest players.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 20 greatest players. So, you know, he's been able to be on a list. I remember his, experience, and it seemed to be pretty cool. And the good thing about that, you know, when it comes to this, and being able to hear what it's like to be a part of it is we can hear from people who have been asked, and that's what we've actually done. In the first of a two-part interview, and we'll play the second half a little bit later, as we mentioned before, we are going to be speaking with Jim Robinson. He gets to talk about his experience when it comes to being on this committee for the 2013 – I know I said this wrong in the interview, but the 2013 Hall of Fame class – being on that committee. So we'll go ahead and listen to the interview that we had with him, the first part, and then we'll be right back. Well, making the Hall of Fame is any player's dream. But what about the process to actually get these few players into the Hall of Fame? So we have somebody with us this week who actually will be able to give us a little bit of insight on how the process is going to be done, etc. With us on the line is Jim Robinson, who is the former longtime Tampa Bay Storm media director and AFL insider. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Well, the list just recently came out. You are in a very – I guess we can say you're in a very unique group. I mean, there are – a lot of the ones that are currently with you this year, Jim, are more than just first-timers. So I guess you and Richard Oliver, I guess, are the only first timers on the committee this year for the Hall of Fame for the 2012 class. First, how did the process go with you getting chosen?
The league called me and asked me if I would be interested, and they said they were putting together a list of names, and I told them certainly I would be interested and I would be honored. And then, we had some follow-up conversations, and, a couple weeks ago they made their selections and informed me that, I was going to receive an invitation to be on the board. And, you know, I was excited. It's a nice honor. It's nice to be able to play a little part in the history of the game.
Jim, when you're looking at the Hall of Fame this year, and obviously you need to pick how many ever candidates it is that you need to select for your particular ballot, and the league will obviously, you know, come down to a selection from there. What is the criteria you're looking for the players in general to put them in the Hall of Fame?
Well, first I start off with the premise, it's the Hall of Fame. So to me that signifies greatness, not really good. And there are a lot of players that played in this league that are really good. And there are some players that exceeded that, and they were great. Some players were great for an extended amount of time, and some players were great for a short amount of time. So now you've gone from apples and apples to apples and oranges a little bit. And you have to have that debate. And I'll be honest, I've come up with a short list. of names that I think deserve to be in the discussion. Will they all get in at some point? Possibly. Do they all get in this year? No. But I think these are all players that deserve an opportunity to be a part of the discussion. And to be honest, I've sought counsel from a lot of people that I know in the league who've been a part of the league for a long time. And it's the fun part about that discussion I've had with these individuals is everybody has something different to say. And one of the things I did ask them is, I don't want you to rank guys. What I would like, though, is to look at this list and say, am I missing somebody? And from my perspective, I want to be all-inclusive first. Here's my list. And then, okay, let me pare this down. And right now I have an alphabetical order. I'm working on breaking it down by, you know, if this was my team and I had to rank guys 1 through 20 or however many guys are on the list, I want to do it that way. I want to break them down by position. And then, you know, there are some positions that are hard to compare to other ones. Offensive and defensive linemen. Not a lot of stats to work off of. Some offensive and defensive linemen, particularly in the Ironman era, they were primary offensive linemen. Some were primary defensive linemen. So the stats are going to be skewed there. And then when you compare that against a wide receiver, wide receivers are going to put up huge numbers, you know, and then take it a step further. How do you compare a wide receiver, especially in that era, who is an offensive specialist, against the wide receiver who was a wide receiver and a jack linebacker? You know, is there added value because they made an impact on two sides of the ball rather than one side? Or was that person a prolific kick returner? Now, were they a great receiver or were they not? How much value do you add there? So those are the things that I'm looking at. That's the process I'm going to work through. You know, I'd still love to make sure that short list is as inclusive as possible. And then once I feel that it is, I'm going to whittle it down and keep going through. And I'm going to go through a bunch of different scenarios and kind of look at where I'd like it to be.
What about when you talk about some of the fans who look at the list and say, well, this person was only in the league, they were, you know, in the early years of the league compared to a player that played, you know, over the past, say, the past 5 years. How are you going to be able to distinguish, you know, an old-time, you know, veteran, old-time veteran versus a new AFL, I guess a new player, so to speak, a new AFL player? You know, to balance it, you know, for a lot of fans may not recognize some of the names that may be brought up in the future.
No, I that's a valid point, and I think that's a terrific argument to bring up, and that's part of my thinking is how do you balance that in the scales? You know, the game transformed from its early years, the first 4 years, and then there was kind of a transformation from 91 up to about 97, and then there was another transformation. The NBC years all the way up to, you know, 2003, and then you have a little bit more of a transformation that occurs in after the 2007 season when you did away with, the two-way guy and the specialist, and you could have, someone that comes in and they're just an offensive lineman and someone that comes in and is just a defensive back. And so, I don't know the answer, but I think you have to look at the impact they made at the time and compare them kind of against their contemporaries. You know, if you look at linebacker from the Chicago Bears, just retired, Brian Urlacher. I've talked to people. Some people think he's a no-brainer. Some people think he isn't a great – he's not a Hall of Fame linebacker. But when you compare him to guys in older eras, you know, the game's different nowadays. Brian Urlacher, at his position, he had to be able to carry a receiver vertical. That didn't happen in the 60s. That didn't happen in the 70s, where two or three plays a series, that linebacker's doing that. So the game's changed a little bit. So I think that's something you have to take into consideration as well, is how the game evolves. And whether the player was in one error, crossed errors, and how, if they did cross errors, how were they able to relate and convert their talents?
Jim, this is the first year that we're going to be seeing players that are eligible to that played in the, quote, new AFL or the AFL version 2.0. What are some of the names that we haven't seen on the Hall of Fame ballot before that would be up for consideration this year?
We'll start off with two quarterbacks. I'll be honest, I currently don't have them on my short list. One is Chris Gryson and the other is Brett Dietz. I think they were on pace, en route to a Hall of Fame career, both of them, but they didn't, I don't know if they really played long enough to do that. There are cases of quarterbacks. Last year was the 25th anniversary of the league. They put out their top 10 list and the quarterbacks they had on there. Some of those quarterbacks aren't in the Hall of Fame and they're not going to get in the Hall of Fame, but they did have stretches during their careers in which they played great ball. Now, I think both those two players right there played great ball, but I don't know necessarily if that was long enough to get that spot into the Hall of Greatness. Outside of that, some of the other guys, I'm going to have to pull up my list here real quick. I can't remember all of them off the top of my head. Dan Alexander would be one. He owns the league record for touchdowns scored in the season. But once again, we're looking at a 5-year career there. Another one, Thrasio stopped playing in 2008. Lawrence Samuels. How could I gloss over that one? Lawrence Samuels played in 2010, so he is eligible for the ballot for the first time this year. And, this is a guy that first player in Arena League history to get 1,000 receptions. He's a player that someone who wants to make an argument against me would say, that guy played a really long time. Really, really good. Is he really, really great? Well, you know what? He's on my short list. I think he's a definite candidate. He's a guy that early in his year, he played a long time, but early in his year, he didn't play much. He played behind two Hall of Famers. He didn't get the fifth field for the first 5-6 years of his career. He played behind Stevie Thomas, and he played behind Jerzel France, two guys that were the quintessential arena football players during their era. Outside of that, I think those are the only guys from the 2010 time that are on there outside of Jay Gruden, who now is eligible as a head coach.
Now, you look at the players themselves. Obviously, it seems like every year, Jim, that the league comes up with somebody who is not actually a player, whether it be a builder or whatever it may be. Give us a little bit of insight if you were to choose somebody who is not considered a player that you would actually say that you're worthy enough to be in the next class of the Arena Football Hall of Fame.
Well, you know what? I think first take the players off the board, then you look at your coaches. I'll tell you I would lean towards players first, coaches second. And now you start to look at, after that, you start to look at your contributors. And your contributors could be anybody from front office executives to commissioners, such as David Baker. It could be to people who played a role in the league, a longtime radio guy or a longtime media guy. I think there are some other guys out there that if you take the look and if we have contributors that are eligible, what level of contribution makes them eligible to get into the Hall of Fame or to at least enter that discussion? And, I think that there's a lot of people that fit that bill. And I think certainly one of them would be one of your fellow compatriots there, Joe. He helped take Arena Fan to new levels. And that's the, outside of the league, that's where you're going to get information. You know, if you want inside information and you want to catch up on what's going on in the league and you want to talk about the league, and he's done a tremendous job with his website and help with the viability and the growth of the league as well. And, you know, I think there's some other guys you could throw into that mix. One of them might be my fellow board members and Ari Wolf, who's had a huge role as a guy that covered teams, reported on teams, whether it was from the radio side, the television side, or wrote about them.
Yeah, Ari goes all the way back to my beginnings in the Arena Football League back in Albany. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. And I think another one is like it could be a Jason Dixon. The league used to give out radio awards, top radio people, and and they called them Netties. He won numerous Netties over his career. So, you know, I think the bottom line is, how do you define what a contributor is and what that level is, or minimum level, to join the discussion? To be quite frank, pardon me, I don't know what that answer is, but I do think those names I mentioned would be worthwhile in discussing. However, my viewpoint is, I would rather see players get in ahead of those people. And that's my personal preference. That's the way I see it. Does that mean they should be precluded? Absolutely not. But, you know, when you break the game down to its most base level, it's about the players in the front of the field.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're currently listening to AFL Tonight with me, Tim Capper, and Adam Markowitz. We're currently speaking with Jim Robinson, who is one of the newest members of the committee for this year's Arena Football League Hall of Fame. He is giving us some great inside information on what it is like to be chosen for this particular committee and the steps that it takes to finally lead up to our newest class within the Hall of Fame.
Jim, I want to ask you about one guy in specific who I know is not going to be voted into the Hall of Fame, and that's Greg White. And I guess the follow-up question before I even get started with that is, what is your opinion about Kurt Warner being in the AFL Hall of Fame? Because when you look at the two careers of White and of Warner, they were basically the exact same amount of time in the Arena Football League. The difference is Kurt Warner was a quarterback and Greg White was a defensive lineman. But if you look at one player in this league who has been able to take that step from the AFL into the NFL and have an extended period of success, that would probably be one of the only other guys on the list. Is this the type of guy that you would consider? Is this the type of thing that you would consider? And again, do you think that Kurt Warner is a deserving member of the Hall of Fame after being voted in 2011?
Let me start off. Interesting argument. I would agree. They have parallel careers, not only in time of service, but I think in impact at position in the league and in their performance. Kurt Warner was one of the top quarterbacks during his time. Greg White was the preeminent sack master during his time. I think the biggest difference there is, And I would understand arguments against this, is that Kurt Warner is the poster child. He also kind of segues into that contributor side of things, because he was the face of the Arena Football League when he made it to the AFL. He's the guy that became an MVP. He's the guy that won a Super Bowl, and that story was told over and over and over and over again. So the answer to why Kurt Warner over Greg White is just that. Greg White went on to have a nice career with the Buccaneers, but by no means was it spectacular. Good career, solid career, great contributor on that defense. But he didn't do what Kurt Warner did in the NFL. Now, how does that impact the AFL? It should. That's the NFL. That's not the AFL. But when you look at the grand scheme of things, Kurt Warner was a face and brought immense attention to the league. And, you know, I wasn't a part of those discussions, but I would have to easily assume that would be the reason why.
Now, for those who don't know, Jim, when it comes to a player being eligible to even, to, you know, to even be thought of being on this, on your list, on, and all the other committee shortlists, what are the rules when it comes to a, for a player to be actually even be thought of?
Oh man, I have that right in front of me. I don't remember it off the top of my head. I want to say if it was the first 4 years of the league, it was 2 years of service. After that, you had to have a minimum of 3 years of service, and you have to have been 3 years removed from the league. Thus, why you have the people who last played in 2010 eligible now. One of the difficulties I would have is the league was in its infancy. There was a lot of turnover. The game really kind of evolved a lot since then. And I'm going to say this and it's sound interesting. They ran the ball a little bit more. And then we got into a real big passing transition where teams didn't run the ball much anymore. And I think you're starting to see that a little bit, more this season, with a variety of teams, taking advantage of using the quarterback or the running game, particularly in the red zone when the field shortens and it becomes harder to find those passing lanes and passing routes. And I think a lot of coaches are more in tune with that, and the philosophy has changed a little bit. But another thing is, those stats are and the information to find on those players those first 4 years are hard to come by. And that might be something similar to what the NFL ended up doing, is that you have another committee down the road in which you have historical players come in. You know, the NFL, when they put their list out, they have the guys who are eligible and the guys who just became eligible, and then they have the veterans list. And that might be a route, you know, how that the league goes. How soon, I don't know. You know, they may wait to do that. But that becomes tough. I do know on my short list, I have a couple of guys that are from that time frame that currently aren't in the Hall of Fame, that I'm debating where they fit in the grand scheme of the 10 guys I'm allowed to submit. And one of those is Willie Wyatt, primarily offensive defensive alignment, but primarily offensive lineman. Another one is, two fullback linebackers, who were teammates together for most of their career, or a long, big part of their career, Les Barley and Andre Bowden. You know, where do they fit in? You know, do you give the nod over one over the other? You know, during the time when you made those, substitutions, it went, one guy went offense, defense, offense. Next guy came in and went defense, offense, defense. So you have to weigh that impact as well. But those are some of the guys I'm looking at from, you know, the early 90s to mid 90s that have been overlooked. And how do they compare and stack up against some guys in the late 90s and the early 2000s and the late, you know, 2006, 7, 8 into 2010?
And that was the first part of the interview with Jim Robinson. And we'll get to the second half a little bit later on when we start talking about the games this week. Some pretty cool insight, though, I will admit, eh, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't envy the position these guys are in, because I think that the several years between Hall of Fame ballots really screwed over all the selection members, because there's probably 35 guys that you could easily and deservedly say they are absolutely Arena Football League Hall of Famers.
Mm-hmm.
But you're only going to be able to pick, you know, a handful of them. To ultimately get in, you have to take this list of probably 100 guys, whittle it down to the ones you really think should be in, and then whittle it down even further to the ones who deserve to be in now.
I know.
And that's tough. And it's only going to get tougher, really, as the years go on. I think these next couple years are a little easier, because there aren't that many people who quote, you know, become eligible in 2011 and 2012 and in all likelihood in 2013 as well. So the time will be there for all these guys, assuming we're still talking about this in a few years. But this is another very tough task. Not quite as hard as it was last year, but still very difficult all the same.
Well, yeah, and, you know, just the possibilities of, you know, some of these people who, you know, that Jim mentioned that you know, are very worthy of, you know, being offered a spot in the Hall of Fame. You know, talk about people in the near future. The only one that I can really think of that will be eligible very shortly is going to be Damien Harrell. And I would not be, I don't think, I don't know. It, depending on who's available, I don't know if he would be a first ballot.
Well,
he
would be next year.
Yes.
So yeah, I don't know if there'd be a first ballot. It's not even necessarily who's going in with him. It's a matter of who's still left after this year. There are some very interesting names on this year's suggested list from what we are gathering that could be potential ones. You know, you heard Jim even bring up Joe.
Yeah.
Bring up Joe Kaufman. That idea. I'm interested to know whether the names of maybe any fans come up, you know, fans who have been around this league for 20 plus years. I'm thinking, you know, like the guys out in Arizona, Peanut and all those guys who travel everywhere. You know, if this is a game for the fans, what better way to do it, you know, to reach out than to honor a fan that way?
Rainbow Wig in LA.
Yeah. I mean, they're not nearly as long.
No.
You know, if you're going to go that route, you can go Captain Soul and Moxie, and they weren't around all that long.
No, but I'm saying at least, you know, the Avengers were about to celebrate the 10-year anniversary, so, you know, that's why I thought of him off the top of my head. So
it's, I mean, it's going to be very interesting. This year's particular crop of newcomers I don't think is really all that great, though I do think there are definitely going to be a couple for – if Lawrence Samuels doesn't get on the first ballot, something's wrong. He absolutely deserves to be in, even though he never won an Iron Man of the Year award. He was clearly one of the five best Iron Men in league history.
Yeah.
I think he absolutely deserves to get in. I think James Barron is a guy who absolutely deserves to get in. And we both know will not. The league will make sure of that because they don't like his affiliation with the AFLPU. But he absolutely is a guy who should be a Hall of Famer. You know, and aside from that, I think those are the two guys, at least in my eyes, that absolutely should be in the Hall of Fame at this point. And who else gets in, you know, we'll see. I could come up with a list, like I said, of 30 deserving names.
Exactly.
Aside from that. But those are the two that really stand out to me as the guys who really absolutely should be in this class of the Hall of Fame.
Now, what about, you know, and, you know, you talk about fans. I'm going to put it out there. I'm going to plead to the league. Let's have... You know, if it's not a part of the AFL Hall of Fame, let's have an AFL Hall of Fame for fans. I mean, I think it could work. You know, maybe just a one inductee per year. We've had, you know, it would take quite a bit of research if you really hadn't been around the league that long, Adam. You'd have to really do some work to find out who would be willing to be inducted, you know, into this new Hall of Fame, so to speak. So it's, I mean, it could be an interesting idea. I mean, the question is, would it work? So, let's see, what else? This past week, we don't know much about it, and we're trying to see if we can get something about it, but, this past week, it was the first ever training camp in China for the AFL Global Group. This is the group that is trying to bring the AFL China, League, starting next year, with the, proposed, let's see, I know it's 10-game season for I can't remember how many teams now. It just totally escaped my mind.
Six teams.
Yeah, thank you. Six teams. So from what I'm understanding, this thing, I don't know, Adam, because I know they've added another exhibition game to their schedule. There's going to be two in China in October, but now there is one actually. From what I'm seeing, there was something put a Q&A done by the league with Commissioner Kurz, who happened to be over there for some of it, that they're going to have another one in September in Hawaii. But it looks like the beginnings of the AFL China League seem to have gone very well. But you know what, Adam? I don't know. There looks like what they want to do is bring in first mostly American players American players. Then bring in Chinese players to play with the American players and then to be all China players. Now my thought to this
I don't know if the interest is necessarily to have all Chinese players. but that the league is growing to within between 3 and 5 years to at least have half of the participation.
Right, right.
Be of Chinese players.
But, you know, for me, it's like, a lot of these guys are just play university ball. What is to say that this is just going to be a quote unquote, okay, amateur league compared to a minor league? That's sort of an oxymoron. I know.
Well, from the standpoint of in China itself,
mm-hmm.
you're talking about this is going to become a way of life for them. This is going to be something that obviously has got to start up, and it's got to start up in the young, you know, in the young developments, even just, you know, how, you know, guys would go out in the streets and play, you know, touch football or
flag
football. The same type of thing. You would see guys playing with arena rules in the streets. It's gotta become, it's really a grassroots type of effort to get the game established
uh-huh.
over there
uh-huh.
by using, whether it be pros, whether it be semi-pros, but eventually having kids that basically get raised on this game. And just as you would be raised to be a hockey player, you'd
right.
be raised to be a baseball player, you'd be raised to be an Arena Football League player.
Right.
In China. And like I said, that's gonna take some years, and that's why it's gonna take a while before we see, you know, the full implementation of this.
And we joke about it too, and I think it was mentioned in that actual article itself that the one of the things that they are looking to do to make sure that they get a lot of the inroad in China is to have it become an Olympic sport. Now, just past week, if I'm not mistaken, the IOC, you know, made their short list smaller. I think it was to bring back baseball, softball. They cut judo, or I can't remember what it was off the top of my head. But if you are in bring it in as an Olympic sport, the question is it going to be taken seriously? You know, you have soccer, but you're never going to have American football or American rules football, gridiron football, being played in the Olympics. It'll never happen.
No, I really. What about where they're going?
Wait, what about this type of football though?
We still have the same problem though. It's still tact, and this is part of what concerns me
mm-hmm.
about bringing over our players to go play over there. How much football can a guy play in that short of a period of time?
Yeah.
You're already asking these players to play 18 games in 19 weeks over here, and some of these guys you're going to be asking to play basically 21 games. In 22 weeks, and then you're going to ask them to go over and play an exhibition over in Hawaii, and then you're going to ask them to play in a couple exhibitions over in China, and then you're going to ask them to come back and play for another 21 games in 22 weeks over here in the States. And, oh, by the way, then you're going to go to China and play a 10-game season.
And we've seen it happen. I mean, you know, in years, in the old AFL, it actually did happen that way.
Yeah, we saw guys who played both in the AFL in Canada and in some of the other leagues and basically become legitimate full-time football players. But I don't know how long a guy can do that for.
Yeah.
I don't know how taxing that is, and I don't know whether they're going to be willing to do it for $825 a week. And I, you know, obviously we don't know what they're going to be paid over in China, but I have to think if you're bringing an American team over there to have an exhibition, they're going to get paid the same way that they're going
to
be paid here.
Right. And it's not the same thing. I don't think you could really, if you were to use, as an example, a Bo Jackson, what he did, baseball, football, same thing with Deion Sanders. I don't think you can use that as an example because it's not football basically, it's not necessarily 24/7, but it's, football 24/7, it's, you know, you're still, that's a lot of football, and I totally.
Those guys, you know, those two guys you just mentioned are also freakish athletes.
Yes.
Though the athletes are great in the AFL, they are not Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders.
No, but it's just as, you know, to use them as an example, but it's, I will admit, I mean, we saw some of the guys that were able to do CFL, come over, do arena, and then head back to the CFL. At least there was a little bit of a layover, you know, because the seasons really didn't overlap. But the problem is that, you know, I agree with you. You remember way back, you have these guys who wanted to play exhibition games when the league did them in the early to late 90s. You know, they had a game here in Calgary, Canada. They had the games over in Europe in the early 80s. You know, sometimes these are just get-togethers. You know, if Iowa showed up, it doesn't necessarily mean it was going to be the Iowa Barnstormers that are currently on the roster. It doesn't mean you're going to have a J.J. Ratterink behind, you know, under center. So I'm curious to see how this is going to work. What type of incentive are these players going to be given to want to play, this much football. Because like I said, they could easily go from full season of AFL to AFL China. And if you think about it, depending on when the AFL China is going to be situated, it may go right back to the AFL season. And you need to rest. You don't want to burn these people out and possibly have their career end by playing in China or, you know, the AFL way too long, right?
Yeah. But that's the other reason why I really don't think that, at least at this point, the Olympics are anywhere near the radar. Just because, how can you reasonably ask these guys to play even four games mm-hmm. in 2 weeks mm-hmm. or even three games in 2 weeks is tough. You know, hockey, you know, you're used to playing on that type of schedule, but football, you can't play three games in 9 days in football. You just can't do it.
No.
So I don't know how they are, that they're planning on doing this. But you gotta figure, you gotta play at least three or four games to be able to come up with fair medals.
Yeah.
At least an 8-team tournament.
Yeah. And it's something, you know, you look at how sometimes the scheduling goes for in the CFL, even though they have 8 teams, you know, sometimes you'll have a game 5 days later or whatnot. That's tough on the body too. So I agree.
But that's also fair from the standpoint that generally when they do that, mm-hmm. they, both teams are doing it, and they're both traveling from the same place.
True,
traveling to the same place.
True, no.
And they also don't do that. You know, they it's only once. You know, they have that 5 day gap, and then they have 9 days off.
Exactly, they'll have a bye week. Exactly, yeah, if necessary. That's true. It's
well, even not a bye week, just a long week of preparation.
They do, yeah. I think usually when they have something like that, they may have a bye week following. But the way that it goes in the CFL, it's very, you know, 2 weeks. Two teams are off in the East. Two teams are off in the West. That's what they've been doing the past couple of years, and they stagger it. So
there's also something about preparation for that. You know, if you're a longtime member of the Calgary Stampeders or the Edmonton, you know, the Edmonton Eskimos, you know damn well you're playing on Labor Day and you're playing 4 nights later
in
the other team's venue. You know that's coming, and you prepare yourself for it, and you have time to prepare yourself for it. In the Olympics, this is going to be the first shot that anybody's had to do this. I don't want to say it's going to be impossible to do, but it just seems like you're setting yourself up for just unless you're going to have rosters of like 30 and 40 guys, just impossible to really have the body hold up for that long.
Right. And I will admit to you, look at when they have the junior football tournament, it's only like 3 games, over an X period of time. So, you know what makes me wonder, and we don't know how the rules are going to be set up for AFL China. Could they possibly change the rules?
One of the things that's been talked about is the idea of shortening the game
mm-hmm.
To make it sort of along the lines of you have a 90-minute soccer match with a 15-minute halftime period,
right.
So that the entire game experience is about 2.5 hours from the point that you would show up to the point that you would go home.
Right.
And trying to put it in that same sort of context at this point.
It makes me wonder if that's, you know, maybe it's something that they'll look at, but it looks like it went very well as far as the first training camp went. I know a lot of veteran players went over to teach the game. I know Commissioner Kurz was there, and obviously the group itself that is heading up AFL China. So seems to be on its way. I know there are a lot of people and a lot of fans are thinking, like, why do this here when they can't seem to get it set up, you know, get their basically all the – everything in order here in North America. You know, it's something different. It maybe could easily be a moneymaker in the future. We don't know, but it's gotten off the ground. And I will admit, for those of you who thought that it wasn't going to get this far, it did. It's gotten this far. And so far, I am curious. So Adam, I will admit, I am curious to see what the exhibitions are going to be like in China and how well they are attended. I think that's going to be the neat thing for October. Hopefully that we will be able to get a chance to see them, either streaming, or in some shape or form. So, what else? Now, talking about what you did earlier, just wanted to at least give a quick shout out. I know you wanted to. You did an interview today. You were able to at least get some information across about what was happening in the AFL. And I know you wanted to at least give a shout out to the gentleman who you spoke with today when it came to your online interview. Are they online? I don't know. Were they online?
Yeah,
they...
online. Okay. Yeah, they're online. Couple local radio guys in Orlando who do an online online radio show. The show is called The Captain and Company. It's on Old School. Old School SKOOL 101 .com, and I had the opportunity to be on them probably about, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes, about 10 minutes or so.
Yes, about 10 minutes.
This
yeah.
morning, talking about some stuff with the AFL going to China and with some of the other cost cutting measures that we spoke of earlier. So thank you, Chris Hill, and all the guys over there at that show.
Now, it was an interesting interview, I will say. but if you happen to hear it, I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you want to get in contact with Adam and myself or us, the team here at Arena Fan, you know how to do it, and there are multiple ways. But if you don't know, there is all of our social media accounts, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. It's both all at Arena Fan, and there are our message boards over at ArenaFan.com. There's also our Twitter account for the show, AFL Tonight, and that is at AFL Tonight, and we will give you our emails at the end of the show. So, Adam, do you like bacon?
We all like bacon. Okay.
Do you like football?
Yeah, we all like football.
Okay. Do you like bacon and football put together? What would you think? Think it works?
I don't know. Is this kind of like, if you like beer and golf, that you're supposed to, chug beers on tee boxes every time?
I don't know.
Something like that. when you score a touchdown, you're going to get a slab of bacon that you have to eat.
Could be like,
or if you get hit with a penalty, you end up having to eat a slab of bacon.
Yeah.
Instead of losing five yards.
It's going to be one of those, fear factor type of things. Yeah. It was very interesting. A very cryptic press release came from the Iowa Barnstormers late last week talking about an announcement that was going to be made by the Iowa Barnstormers that was going to change the face of the 2013 season for the Iowa Barnstormers. Yeah, it was an interesting announcement. They announced that the Barnstormers are going to be hosting the first ever Bacon Bowl. I kid you not, ladies and gentlemen. First ever Bacon Bowl, if you're kosher, by the way. I don't know if you'll be able to attend. First ever Bacon Bowl on July 20th, 2013, between the Barnstormers and I think the Utah Blaze.
Yeah. And I would like to know what these two teams have to do with each other. They have to fight it out for a trophy of bacon.
This thing looked – it looked – first and foremost, the mascot. The mascot was even funnier. I saw a picture with the – I mean, it looks Porky Pig. That's what it looked like.
We'll put these pictures up on our Facebook page.
Porky Pig carrying a trophy of a silver football – and
on top of a slab of bacon.
On top of a slab of bacon.
That's basically what it looks like.
Basically what it was. It's basically, and you know what? We laugh, but this is, it's a great gimmick. It has to do particularly with the Blue Ribbon Bacon Festival. It's being recognized as the mecca of all bacon festivals. The world's premier bacon festival. How many times did I say festival? It takes place annually in Des Moines, Iowa, and it's organized and promoted by the Iowa Bacon Board. Oh my God. The guys over at Epic Mealtime would love these guys. The uniquely quirky celebration offers participants extensive bacon sampling, bacon lectures, bacon-inspired dishes, bacon competitions, an annual bacon queen that gets better by the moment, bacon awards, live entertainment, and Bacon Fellowship.
Bacon Fellowship.
I don't know.
To be totally honest with you, if I lived in Des Moines,
yeah,
I might be intrigued enough by this just to go see it to laugh at it. And all kidding aside about that, if I'm the Iowa Barnstormers and I'm trying to pitch to a guy like me, you don't give a damn how your fans come out there. You don't care if they're coming out there for bacon or football.
Yeah.
As long as they're coming out there, that's all that really is all that makes a damn bit of difference.
Yeah.
So, I give props for trying.
Oh, they went all out.
Though I gotta say with this one though, I mean, Iowa guys, I love you up there. This is the dumbest press release that I have seen.
I'm reading it
now.
The day
that the Jacksonville Sharks introduced chum and made it seem like it was the biggest thing in the world.
Oh God, especially if you know what chum is. I
think chum is a mascot.
No, but what is
it? Oh, if you know what chum is in real life.
Exactly, exactly what chum is in real life. And no, we're not talking about Chumley, the guy on Pawn Stars. No, we're not talking about him, but chum, it's what
basically to keep it clean.
What?
To keep it clean. Shark food.
Yeah. It attracts sharks. Basically what it is.
It's not a bad name for a mascot if you're not going to use Jaws.
No, that's true too. But you know
they made it sound like chum was going to be, you know, the next. At the time, I don't even think the Sharks had a quarterback, but they're making this big announcement over a mascot.
Yeah, I remember. But you know what? That's the cool thing when it comes to minor league sports. You have to sometimes bring out some really quirky stuff. And you got to admit, the way that the Barnstormers Bacon Bowl press release starts off today, if we could do the voice from the guy dude who has a low voice who does all the trailers is like, today. More than half of all U.S. homes, 53%, keep bacon in their fridge at all times. Like, then again, according to Pork Checkoff, bacon has become the fastest growing pork category in the last 10 years. I mean, Adam, they went all out.
Give him credit for trying.
Yeah, but you know what?
If every team had the connection to do something as gimmicky as this, mm-hmm. and was able to make it as big as the Barnstormers. I'm really interested to see how many people show up at the well. This may be the most intriguing thing to me for the rest of the season. Damned who's actually going to be here in the Arena Bowl. How many people are going to show up at the Bacon Bowl?
But you know what? Hey, they're going all out. They even have Bacon Bowl packages, and they are currently available. Oh, if you go to BlueRibbonBaconFestival.com.
Got to join the Bacon Fellowship.
Each package will include an entrance to the bacon tailgate and a ticket to the game. The ticket package.
We gotta see if we can get these people on next week.
Yes.
That's what we need to see if we can get on.
The ticket packages are $25 each and will be made available at precisely noon on Thursday, June 6th.
See if we can get some free bacon if nothing else.
That is classic stuff, man. That is really, really fun. I mean, I get, again, all out. I had no clue. I had somebody tweet me that there's this big announcement coming up. I had seen the PR. I had no clue what this is about. And we know this, Adam, but from the years in the Arena Football League, I said, all you gotta say is one word. Chum. That's all you gotta say. So it's...
Yeah, when somebody says something's a BFD, it better be a BFD.
Yeah.
If I showed up at that press conference, I'd be pretty PO'd, but, you know.
Again, props. I mean, it's interesting.
I mean, they had J.J. Ratterink there. They had a couple other guys there sitting there for this announcement.
Yeah, with this bacon trophy. I mean, and this mascot.
I hope the Barnstormers are in the Arena Bowl now and bring that thing with them.
Oh, that would, yeah. You know, this would be a lot better if this were between, let's say, the Iowa Barnstormers and the Omaha Beef.
Exactly.
Yes, I was thinking it. It's like, that has to be it. But, you know, alas, it's not the case, but, very interesting. Question from the fans. Did I forget anything else before we get to that? Question from the fans. Again, you guys came firing on all cylinders. Again, guys, you do know that there are certain things that we really cannot answer. Please. Please try not to ask them.
And don't put things on there that are going to make us ban you or delete the post. Cause I had to do a bunch of that today and that's not cool.
And we don't, you know what? We're not really one to ban, but yeah, we will take away the post itself because sometimes it's not really necessary. Anything about Commissioner Kurz, we really can't answer. Yeah. Again, we'll reiterate that. But there are certain things that we really can't talk about. Obviously, shout out to Jacqueline, who wanted us to mention the Bacon Bowl. You got it. Got a lot of mentioning about the Bacon Bowl. But as, you know, I said, Adam, maybe we need to get these guys from this Blue Ribbon Festival, Bacon Blue Ribbon Festival to join us and to give him a little bit of airtime about this. So, I gotta open my posts here. We had some added questions since we've been talking here, Adam. Okay, interesting stat. This comes from Riley Wheaton. The Power's been shut out in the third quarter the last three games in a row, and in four games this season, they are 1-3 when they are shut out in the third quarter. Can you speculate on what it is about the third quarter that causes this team so much grief?
Yeah, first of all, that's a great stat. Mm-hmm. I had to go back and look that up and go, wow, that really is the case. They really have not scored a single point in the third quarter of their last three games. And the answer is simple. If you're not scoring in the third quarter or you're getting badly outplayed in the third quarter, you're getting out coached. And that's the bottom line. You can go back and look through history of coaches who have gotten fired in the Arena Football League who deserve to get fired, and they all have the same problem. They can't score in the third quarter because they go into the locker room and they get just brutalized.
Yeah.
That was one of the massive problems with the Predators last year. They just got whipped in the third quarter of so many games that they were in. So many of those comebacks that they gave up were all destructive in the third quarter. That's why Brent Muncy got fired, because they felt like every time that team went into the locker room, and whether it's a matter of complacency or game plan changes or whatever the case is,
right.
it didn't work. Sorry, Coach Stingley, you're not one of the better coaches in this league, and that's why the Power – well, let me rephrase it. A part of the reason why the Power are in the boat that they're in right now, coming out of the locker room in the third quarter.
Yeah, that's just absolutely horrible. I wasn't able to check the stats on how many points the Power has actually scored overall in the third quarter of the season, but
67.
67. That, see, that's bad.
That's bad. Yeah, that is very, very bad.
So, I mean, it's yeah.
They are being outscored in the third quarter of game. I'm sorry, 68, not 67.
It's okay.
They're being outscored 107-68 in third quarters this year. Of course, that's not as bad as they're being outscored in the first quarter, 127-57. And by the way, that goes back to coaching. You're coming out of the blocks. These are your first drives that your coaches are drawing up this year, or in the games.
Yeah. I will admit the Power have been doing a little bit better since they've had their new quarterback. Jefferson just really didn't seem to be cutting it. But yeah, wow, three straight quarters. You know, I talked about last week how I was surprised to see two teams not score at all in the third, but to hear that one team is not able to, has not scored in three straight games in the Arena League in the third quarter, that's unheard of. It's absolutely unheard of. Another question came to us from Melvin Moten. Sort of a two-parter here, Adam. What did we learn in Philly on Saturday, and what did we learn in San Antonio on Monday?
What did we learn in Philadelphia? Okay, we learned in Philadelphia that the Soul can play. The Soul can play with the Rattlers, and if they get a third shot at them this year, it's probably going to be an out-and-out war.
Mm-hmm.
What we also learned, though, this Arizona team has just a ton of moxie to it. It's a team that apparently is not going to give up even when it gets down. This is really the second bit of major adversity this team has faced, really, I mean, largely in 2 years. And the fact that they were able to go on the road in what felt like a 1 o'clock local game, the game was played at 4 o'clock on the East Coast, lost Virgil Gray in the game, were able to still come back from down 15 points in the last 4 minutes and win a game that really they had no right even being in with as badly as they played in the middle of that game. I believe the run was something like 50-21 they got outscored at one point in the game. I don't have it in front of me, but it was by a whole hell of a lot of points. It really shows a lot about that Arizona team. One other stat that I was looking at today and found, Derek Ross didn't score a touchdown in that game, and he had gone 33 consecutive games scoring at least once, and I believe the number, again, don't have it in front of me right now, was 11 consecutive games scoring at least twice, including in every single game this year. And Arizona kept him out of the end zone, and they kept him at just 10 yards. So that, it's really saying something about the Rattlers on both sides of the ball. This isn't just a team that's stacked at receiver and has one of the best quarterbacks, if not the best quarterback, in the league. This team plays some defense too.
And just to go on your stat, great stat. And when you told me this, prior to us taping, I was like, we were keeping track way back when of the the wide receivers that have the most consecutive games with a receiving touchdown. And I think you and I were, I think both basically agree that as far as we can tell, unless anybody can correct us, whether it be in the league or the fans itself, we think this might be an actual record for the amount of touchdowns scored in a row in AFL history, we're thinking. But I said if you can let us know otherwise, remember, AFL only. AFL only, so.
Oh, I guess I got to answer the second part of that question, too.
Yes.
What did we learn in San Antonio?
You don't go for two. It's a, I don't understand.
I don't totally disagree with that. No. You know, we continue to learn that Tommy Grady's got problems. Three touchdowns, two picks, 41 points, seven of which came from a pick six. It's not good. I don't think we learned a whole heck of a lot about Xavier Lee. Mm-hmm. He can run, but we knew that already. You know, Utah is in a ton of trouble. And I think that's probably the biggest takeaway, from this game. This team is now three games back, of getting into the playoffs. And we're at the point now, there's only eight games left. They are running out of time. And the truth of the matter is, they may be out of time. It may be too late for Utah at this point. From San Antonio's standpoint, you know, it was a typical San Antonio game. They were sloppy on offense. They did a little bit on special teams, a little bit on defense. They made a couple plays when they had to, and they were able to salt the game away. That's how they've been winning games. How they've been losing games, they've been getting their doors blown off. The good news for San Antonio, that was their first win in conference this year, but they're going to need a whole hell of a lot more than that if they're going to get into the playoffs.
Well, considering all who, so we'll get to it in a couple of minutes on who they play this week, so it's – It could be very, very tough for them. I mean, who would have thought? You know, they're half a game out there behind Chicago. So it's, you know, and poor Utah lost two straight games by 1 point. I mean, it's just, I didn't get it this week. I thought, take your chances in overtime. I know, and this is, maybe this is just, for me, that's just old school football talking to me, and I know there's a, I know you're able to look at it differently, Adam. I would have taken my chances in overtime. I mean, especially with the way that the rules are in the Arena Football League in overtime.
You still got to make a kick, and then you're still 50-some-odd seconds left in the game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I understand what the thought process was. Again, you're talking to somebody who would go for two every single time. So, you know, I don't blame coaching staff for the Blaze in this one. Now, if you want to go after the team for some of the stupid penalties, some of the careless turnovers, that's a different story. But I don't think the decision to go for two at the end was what really, you know, look, if they make it and they win the game by a point, we think, you know, we think they're all geniuses. Okay?
Right, right. I think, as I said, for me, I would have at least gone to overtime. But, you know, I think with that loss, they probably may have taken themselves completely out of the Western Division race.
They were done with that anyway.
Yeah, possibly with the.
But I think they're done at this point.
I don't think they
have enough time.
Yeah, agreed.
Hey, shout out to Kyle Cook, who probably didn't think I was actually going to do it, but he's talking to me on Facebook now.
Oh, nice.
There you go.
Let's see. Nope. let's see. What are we else talking about here?
Let's go to the officiating question in Orlando. I remember
go
that.
Go for
one.
It. Go for it. Okay.
Read the question.
All right. It's from John Benoit, or John Benoit, depending on how you pronounce it, French or English, or American, rather. Do you think the officiating was kind of terrible in the Orlando versus Chicago game? As it seems like all the calls, or at least most of the calls, went against Orlando, and Orlando couldn't buy a break. What are your thoughts on the officiating in the Orlando game?
Orlando couldn't buy a break because Orlando couldn't take its break. You know, the truth of the matter is there were only 10 penalties in the game. You know, the one ejection that happened in the game was, from Chicago's standpoint, and to be totally honest with you, I thought Julius Wilson should have been thrown out of that game the first time he got into it.
Yeah.
The call on the goal line in the fourth quarter, which is, I know the one you're alluding to, was a god-awful call when they called him that. For those of you who don't know, who didn't see it, Wandy Rutledge gets the ball on third and goal from, I believe it was the 2 yard line, and he's plowing forward, and they ruled that forward progress was stopped, and it was a god awful call. He should have scored a touchdown. The next play, they basically ran the exact same thing on fourth down and got stopped, and the Predators never really had another legitimate chance again. That was a terrible call, but I don't think the officiating was as egregiously bad as we have seen in the past. If you're Orlando, catch some passes. Don't drop 7 passes in a game. You know, don't get in all this crap. Don't get stopped on 4th and goal at the 1. Period.
Yeah.
Don't get stopped. And you know what? Don't lose to a team that you were probably more talented than. You know, love the rush, love everything that those boys from Rockford have been able to put together this year. They're probably not as talented as the Predators are. That was a game Orlando should have won. They were favored in that game for a reason.
Yep.
I don't blame the officials. I blame the Predators.
It's funny. Out of all the stuff that we've been talking about over the past year, the officials haven't come up. What?
Shh. Don't jinx it.
No, it's a good thing. You know, you don't want to talk about the refs. I mean, well, no, nothing with the crap that's happened anyways. But, yeah, I didn't see the actual play in question, but it can be very frustrating when it just seems that that you are just getting everything called against you, and you just really can't seem to buy a break or anything like that. So, you know, penalties, you know, it's funny. Penalties in this game, there weren't that many though, Adam. I mean, it's funny, only 10 total penalties were called, in this game, but yet a call that's not made or a call that is made can really stand out, especially with the outcome with what ended up happening between the two teams. So, that's it. I think we're done this week. I am greatly appreciated again to all of the fans who have submitted questions. It wouldn't be a new segment of the show if it wasn't for you guys asking these questions. And as we normally do, we'll be making sure that we ask you to chime in with all your league-related questions right before we do taping each week of AFL Tonight. The games this week. Let me see. What we're going to do is, as you know, War and I 4 this week is coming up, and it has to do with the games that we're going to be doing. So what we're going to do is we're going to continue with the second half of our interview with Jim Robinson. He's going to give a little bit of his insight for the War and I 4. It's a 52-second matchup between the two teams, and he gives a lot of great insight, especially since he's been around for so many of the games. So when we get back, we will talk about the schedule of the week, and then we'll wrap up the show. But currently listening to the second half of our interview. Enjoy.
Jim, the team you're obviously most familiar with, the team you worked for and with for a number of years, Tampa Bay Storm, and obviously the premier game that the Storm play, or games that the Storm play every year against the Orlando Predators. This week you've got the 52nd meeting in this series all time. What is this like, and is this one a little bit different than all the other ones?
Yeah, it is. You know, since 2010, rivalries have been renewed and rivalries have been created, and there are some pretty good rivalries. But when you have one like the War and I-4 with the tradition and the history that it has, it's on its own level. I give you a quick little story of my first experience of the War and I-4. Before I even went to my first game, I'm reading stories in what was then the St. Pete Times, now the Tampa Bay Times, about the rivalry and how Jay Gruden, before he went to become the head coach over there, how he was treated and what happened to his wife and family when they went and what happened to our fans and how they were treated in the arena. And just amazed. And I would go talk to the people in the office and ask, is this for real? Did this really happen? They're like, yeah. And it just kind of blew my mind. And I'd read what the writers from the Times would write, comparing the rivalry to these great college rivalries. And so I make my first trip to Orlando, and I don't know what to expect, but I show up, and we're greeted, and everything looks nice. They're more than welcoming, making sure everything's taken care of. Like, you know what? I don't know what all the hubbub's about. And then the doors open, and the fans start to come in. And that old arena, the arena, was tremendously loud. It was not the biggest arena in the league, but they packed it out, and it was a rowdy atmosphere, and it was loud. And So sure enough, at some point, I need to make my way to the players area, the bench area, which is a tunnel. So you're surrounded on the left, the right, and above you, behind you, by fans. And sure enough, I get plunked with popcorn and beer poured on me. I look over and I see a guy in the front row flicking nickels at our head coach, and then he's flicking nickels at our assistant coaches.
They were the lucky ones.
Get another spin. And that just tells me everything that I was hearing and wondering about and going, nah, I can't be that crazy. It was that crazy. And I don't want people to think like, oh, throwing things and there's violence. And I want to use the word hatred. It was a mutual admiration of dislike. And they respected each other for the talent. They knew they were going to, didn't matter what they did during the season, they were probably going to see each other in playoffs, and that was going to be for all the marbles. And, you know, when you look at it and you look at the teams throughout the league history who have gone to play in the Arena Bowl or going to play in the playing game, no teams have been there more than Tampa Bay and Orlando. And so when you put all that together, that's a great recipe for a tremendous rivalry.
Jim, when it comes to the actual rivalry between the two teams, I mean, what about intensity? I mean, compared to game one to now compared to game 52, I mean, is it the rivalry just as intense?
Yeah, yeah. And I think one of the things you can look at is since we came back in 2010, the Predators made the playoffs first year, and there's been kind of a slow decline there. Tampa Bay went to the Arena Bowl first year, and then they had two down seasons. And now they're looking like a contender this year, and Orlando is struggling. But prior to that, each team had their great seasons. Each team had their good seasons, and each team had their down seasons. When these teams met, the records don't matter. This is the 52nd game, so the 51 previous games. Tampa Bay has a one-game lead in the series. The total combined points scored, the point differential, off the top of my head, I haven't looked at it in a while, I won't say it's 9 points. And so I've seen Orlando come into the Ice Palace then, Tampa Bay Times Forum now. They're the team to beat. They're riding high. And they absolutely get their teeth kicked in by the storm. And I've seen it go the other way. I've seen Orlando Predators limping into that arena and Tampa Bay at home, pumped up, come out, and they get their teeth kicked in. The records never seem to matter in this series. And the interesting thing about it, as close as that point total is, over all those combined games, if you look at the history of the scores of the games, there's very few games that have been decided by less than one touchdown. And so to me, that just exemplifies the fact that records don't matter. Doesn't matter how you're playing. All we know is this week is the 1-on-4, Tampa Bay, Orlando, we're going to get it on. And I don't think there's anything greater than that.
And over the course of the last six games in the series, the last three have been decided by 18, 24, and 24 points. But, of course, the three games before that were only decided by a grand total of 5 points. So there really is that mixed bag there. Jim, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you your thoughts on the Storm for 2013. Just how good is this team, and what does this team have to do to be able to win an Arena Bowl this year?
Let me first off say, I listened to your broadcast with Derek Sharp, our color commentary on the radio, and he asked the same question, and I concur with a lot of what he said. I have to agree that Tampa Bay is a threat to get to the Arena Bowl, but there are certain things that have to happen, and there are certain things they need to fix in order to improve those odds. There are several good teams out there this year, even in the same division with Jacksonville. You know, the other division, Philadelphia's leading it. They took one in Tampa, 2 weeks ago. I don't think either of those teams are teams Tampa Bay can't beat. out west, you have the juggernaut that is the Arizona Rattlers, and you have some pretty good teams with Spokane Shock and the San Jose Sabercats this year. They're playing good ball. The only team that has not had ups and downs would be the Arizona Rattlers, and they had a tough defeat against, well, I want to say it's the Shock. Is that right, guys?
Yep, that's right.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so if we start there, do I think they're a contender? Yeah. How do they get there? They need Adrian McPherson to stay healthy. As he goes, the Storm will go. What will dictate how he goes, though, is the play of the offensive line. And the play of the offensive line in the past couple weeks has not been where it should be and where it had been previously early in the season. And it has impacted the play of the offense. Even in Iowa, you know, they still put 65 points up on the board, but Adrian was sacked a season high 6 times. You can't have that. You don't want your key piece of the equation getting hit and potentially getting injured. And when he's getting that pressure, the offense isn't going to move as smoothly as it can. We've seen Tampa Bay lose a couple games, and we've seen them blow some teams out. The difference in all those games is the consistency. First off, is the consistency of the offense. When the offense is humming, nobody can stop them. I believe that. There's no one really that can stop when the offense is humming. But the offense only hums when the offensive line plays well, and that hasn't been happening. On the flip side of the coin, during those losses recently, they got just beat up in the defensive backfield. That's been a sore spot for the team the 2 previous seasons. I know in the league rankings, they've been top 3 in pass defense in 2012-2011. But we're not kidding ourselves. That's because there were short fields and onside kicks, and teams weren't throwing the ball that much. So this season, though, they've got some playmakers, some guys that don't mind. I shouldn't say don't mind getting beat. Nobody wants to get beat, but they understand the premise of the game. You're going to get beat, so you better make some plays, and they're making plays. And, you know, that's why the turnover differential is a 180 from where it was last year, and that's why the team is at the top of the league in interceptions. Those guys are making plays. If they're healthy, they will continue to make plays, but that's the key thing, is keeping them healthy. The guys that are behind them, will they make plays? Yeah, but they're not as consistent, and they won't make those great plays with the same frequency. The defensive line, I'd say adequate. I wouldn't say great. I wouldn't say bad. They've had their better games. They've had some worse games. As long as they can find ways to keep pressure on the quarterback, to keep him from finding his mark when he drops back, they'll give those DBs an opportunity, and if they do that, I like that defense. If the defensive line can't get there, it's really a football. DBs are going to get beat. And really, I think it's that simple. I know from talking to front office personnel, they're doing a lot of different things to bring guys in to show them, hey, this is how you win. This is how you practice. This is how you prepare. This is how you focus. Yesterday, Derek Brooks brought in Warren Sapp, and that's just an example. What's Warren Sapp going to do? Nothing. He's not going to suit up. He's not going to go play. He's not going to be the quarterback killer. But he's one of a long line of guys that come in week in, week out, and talk to these guys, to the players on the Storm team, and say, hey, this is what it takes to be a champion. This is what it takes to succeed. This is the dedication, the hard work you have to put in. This is the level you have to be at, and once you're there, you have to think that's not good enough. And to me, does that put them in the arena ball? No. Does that make them a contender? Yes. There's some good teams out there. You still got to go out. You still got to beat people on the field. And, you know, I think they have a legitimate chance. I definitely think they make the playoffs. I know some of the people listening are going to go, well, duh, look at New Orleans and Orlando and Pittsburgh, but you know what? They win some games too. You know, you never know what can happen and when a team's going to drop a game. You know, we went out to San Jose, they thump us. They go out the next week and they get thumped. So, you know, what it boils down to is getting in the tournament.
Well,
what you got to do. That's first goal, and I think they do that.
Yeah, I will admit, I've talked to Adam about this before, Jim. When it comes to the team itself, if we were to look at if they're an award for a comeback player of the year, I think AD Mack would easily get that award, in my opinion. I will admit it would be great to see AD Mack back playing for another championship. It would be his first since he went to the Grey Cup a few years ago. But you know, obviously, the team's been doing great, and I think Adam, I think you said that he was probably one of the best street free agents that the team could have picked up this year.
Absolutely, it was definitely one of the best street free agents that anyone picked
up. No doubt. I think no matter where the team finishes, he's a legitimate MVP candidate. You take him off this team, and you put in any guy from 2011 or 2012, it's not the same team. The only difference is the defensive backs. I'd say this group is more athletic and they make more plays. But outside of that, you can swap in a receiver for a receiver. Trade Prichet to Greg Ellingson. To me, those are apples and apples. But the quarterback play has been the key factor in the success. And I got to say, the play of the line this year, I want to say they're second to last in the league in sacks allowed. And, you know, the past couple of seasons, they've been middle of the pack. And I know that's something Coach Wood takes a lot of pride in, and they're just not getting it done. They're not getting it done.
Now, Jim, if people wanted to get in contact with you, whether it come when it has to do with maybe their suggestions for their suggestions of players for the Hall of Fame, or if they want to just get in contact with you to ask you a question, whatever it may be, how would they do that?
The best way is hit me up on Twitter, Jim S. Robinson. I tell you what, if the fans are listening, I welcome suggestions for my shortlist. I welcome opinions, and I'll take that in consideration. I still have time before I need to start paring it down, so I'd love to have that shortlist be as complete as possible and be able to say, hey, these were guys that were a part of the discussion that deserve to be a part of the discussion. And then I think when you do that, it bolsters the case of the guys you do pick, because you can say, this is why this guy gets in and that guy doesn't, and that guy's pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, I want to admit, last year I think was the first time I actually had spoken with you directly. You are a man who knows the game very, very well, and congratulations on being nominated to the committee. I'm sure it comes from both, obviously, everybody at Arena Fan, including Adam and myself. So very well deserved, and we want to thank you for joining us this week.
Oh man, guys, thank you so much. I appreciate it. This was fun to sit down and talk to you guys and chat about arena football and things we've experienced and where the league is going. And it was just a fun time, and I appreciate it. And I hope you welcome me back sometime in the future.
You know, by all means. Everybody, that was Jim Robinson. For a guy that's been working in the Arena Football League for such a long time, Adam, along with yourself, obviously, being a part of the history of the war in I-4, he had a great insight on the team itself and how far he thinks that the team is going to go this season.
Yeah, there aren't many opinions that I trust more in this league than that of Jimmy, who I've known personally now since 2006, I believe. And if not for the fact that, I know somebody had to be at the Storm game that night at my wedding, he probably would have been at my wedding that night.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's how close I am with him. So it's glad to have him I mean, I'm glad to have the opportunity to have him on. And yeah, when he says that's what happens in the War of I-4, you know, that's absolutely how it is. And the story that he shared, you know, with the fans getting on his case and getting on the case of Markham and all that, it absolutely happened. I was there. I lived it all. Hell, I was one of the ones bitching and moaning at Markham, you know, the whole time when he's coming up with his crap of Orlando fans and what happens when Cousins marry and all that. So I don't agree with him that it is what it has been. Maybe it is on the field, but it certainly isn't off the field. But it doesn't, you know, Orlando is still going to have its contingent of fans. It's just not going to have four busloads like we used to have back in the day.
Yeah, no, and you know, I've not had the pleasure to actually attend a game. I've seen a many a War and I-4 on television. Obviously, it's not the same. You know, same thing with any Arena Football League game. You have to actually be there. You know, it's like the bang. One weird comment comes out, you know, like the Banjo Bowl in Winnipeg, between Winnipeg and Saskatchewan. One player opens his mouth, and all of a sudden, boom, something is created entirely. So it's I hope to one day be able to actually attend a game in Orlando or in Tampa Bay for a War and I-4 game. The schedule this week, all games are going to be on Saturday except for one, and the Friday game is actually going to be the Iowa Barnstormers, who came very close to winning last week. Basically, I think what really turned the game around, in my opinion, was that safety. They are traveling to Cleveland.
Let's call it the Corned Beef Hash Bowl. I mean, we're, I don't know where they're going to go with this one, but, you know. This is a story of two teams that are in a whole hell of a lot of trouble right now. Iowa just can't – Iowa just seems like it's missing something this year. And I can't, you know, totally put my finger on what it is. But they've lost three games in a row, and boy, have they looked bipolar in doing so. They scored 62 points against Tampa Bay. They only scored 60 in the other two previous games combined. I mean, this is a team that's gotten into the 60s four times and has been held in the 30s three times. 30s or lower three times. That said, they're the better team. I don't know if they're going to win this game. Obviously, it's a very important game for both teams. Iowa's got the worst record in the conference, and just like Utah, I can make the argument that they're as good as done at this point, especially if they don't win this game, knowing what's on tap for them. They've got San Jose and a road game at Philadelphia coming up after this one. The road for Cleveland is at least a tad easier than at Orlando, at Jacksonville, but they still have two with Orlando, one with Pittsburgh left. The race for Cleveland to get the six or seven wins is on. I'm going to give Cleveland the slight edge in this game, though nothing would surprise me.
Now, the way, you know, the amount of points that was put up, and it was almost back and forth between, you know, Iowa and Tampa Bay last week. Cleveland, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's funny. You know, Coach Hohensee is actually 8-2 all time versus Coach Tann, 4-2 overall versus Cleveland itself. Gladiators do lead the overall series since they first played in 2010. But, you know, I don't know. The only time that they've played in Cleveland, Cleveland has won. I probably would give them a slight edge on this one, but I just don't know. If Ratterink can get hot, then I think almost anything can happen. So it's, you know, a slight edge, I think, to Cleveland, but, I would not be surprised if Iowa wins this game. I got an interesting stat for you. I'm going to bring this up in a minute here, Adam, and I don't know how I'm going to – I could segue this in easily, but I don't know how I'm going to do this. But first, New Orleans travels to play Philadelphia. Our guys at Arena Fan, the fans have Philadelphia favored by 18 points. I think the question for this game would be is – would you start Chris Dixon in this game?
Why? I mean, Kurt Rocco put up 69 points last week.
Good point. Yeah,
against
that's
the lousy Gladiators.
Yeah, even though supposedly rumor is that he was playing on a bum knee the entire game. But,
well, here's what I'll say about Philadelphia. And obviously, I think we're both going to pick Philadelphia in this game.
Yes.
But
yes.
If you're the soul, again, at home this year, you have not been very good at all. Obviously, the team collapsed last week against Arizona, was beaten by Pittsburgh, was beaten by Cleveland, was beaten by Jacksonville. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but if there was a game this week that's going to be a 16, 17, 18, how many ever point underdog, could win outright, this would be the game. There's something about the soul that's just not trusting about them. And this is the only fear that I would have if I were Coach Dolezal going into the playoffs. They beat the teams they shouldn't, you know, that they could struggle against. But boy, the teams that they should be beating or in the situations they should be winning games, they're just choking.
Yeah.
So I'd be worried a little bit, but I mean, obviously, you know, we're going to have to go with the percentages here and go with Philadelphia to beat New Orleans.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, the Soul itself has won the last four games in this series between the two teams. Philadelphia has won by an average of, has scored on average 69 points in those four games. And New Orleans has not even been close. So yeah, I mean, I would not be surprised if Philadelphia puts up a huge number, on the Soul and, you know, but then again, you know, think about it, you know, New Orleans is still technically in the damn race for a playoff spot, so.
Hell, in the damn race. Mm-hmm. They're game back.
Mm-hmm. I know. So, next game. We're talking about it before. War on I-4. Going to be the game of the week on the CBS Sports Network.
Why? Why does anyone want to see this Orlando team?
It's War on I-4, man.
Yeah, great. You saw all the War on I-4 went down the first time.
Yep. Earlier this year, Tampa Bay beat Orlando 53-35.
Close.
Nope. And that's it. This is the 52nd all-time meeting between these two teams. One of the storied rivalries in all of sports. I'd give it easily. I think what we need to watch is AJ McPherson. Watch AD Mack. Let's see if he continues his hot streak when it comes to the rushing touchdowns. He is becoming, I think, once he starts getting into the 30s, which could be this week that he gets into rushing.
Well, let's see. AD Mack at this point has 29 rushing touchdowns.
Yeah, so
I would say he is going to get into the 30s.
If he gets
week.
Into the 30s, we're only week 12. He's coming oh so close to the all-time league record.
Yeah, I mean, the Storm are healthy now, and they weren't healthy when they came to Orlando the first time. Now, granted, Kyle Rowley is not with the Predators anymore. Well, is not playing with the Predators anymore either at this point. And I would sincerely doubt that this game is going to start with a pair of Kyle Rowley interceptions and that the Storm are going to be spending the first – basically the entire first quarter on, you know, with their offense sitting on the bench.
Uh-huh.
But this is still not going to be – Orlando is just such a wreck right now. I can't even begin to tell you how bad this organization – how bad a shape this organization is in at the moment. And just things are not going right. This is a team that only has 6 wins over the course of the last 2 seasons. I mean, fathom that for a second.
Yeah.
You know, this is an organization that year after year after year after year was able to put up great records. I mean, ever since that, I mean, throw out the first year where they only went 3-7, but they won 9 games, 10 games, 11 games,
yeah.
7, 9, 10, 9, 7, 11, 8, 7, 12, 10, 10, 10, 8, 9, 8, 11. And then all of a sudden, 6-22. And you know, if you want to go back to you know, the playoff game that they played before that, this team is 6-23 in its last 29 games. There isn't a team in the AFL that has as bad of a record as that in that stretch of 29 games. Amazingly.
Yeah, it's
and it's going to be 6-30 after this week.
It's just funny how
6-24
where Orlando has gone, the organization has gone in the past couple of years. It's. But you know what?
Sad.
They do. The good thing is that they do. These two teams still get up to play each other. It's you know, it's a war on I-4.
Well, sure. I mean, you do have a bunch of players, especially on Orlando, that have played on Tampa Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much in the other. In fact, I don't know if there's anyone in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there is, but off the top of my head, I just can't think of any. But these guys flip. I mean, it's very easy to get cut by Orlando and picked up by Tampa Bay or vice versa because
oh,
you only
yeah.
have to, you know. You can practically hop a cab and get there.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. Now, fans in Rockford will be having their first home game of the year, their first of 3. Utah's going to be traveling to Rockford to play the Rush. This, Adam, is going to be the first neutral site regular season game played since Arizona played the Houston Thunder Bears at the Maverick Center in West Valley City, Utah, Saturday, June 30th, 2001.
Well, this isn't really a neutral site game per se.
It technically is a neutral site game.
It's technically a home game for the Rush.
It is. Well, yeah, but that game for Houston was a... I know what you're getting at, but...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm not picking against the Chicago team right now. Are you? I mean,
No, no, I will admit it. As I said earlier in the show, it's hard to believe that, you know, it's... I'm looking at this now. I'm like, there's no way I can pick against them. They're surprising the hell, you know, a lot of us. So it's... No, I really could not choose against them. As you said, you know.
And if you're Utah, if you lose this game, you are done. This is a game mm-hmm. you have to win.
Yeah.
If the Rush get past, you know, we've seen the Rush play well at home. We've seen the Rush play like garbage at home at times. If the Rush get over the fact that they're playing in Rockford, and like, I don't know whether the stadium's a dump. I've never seen it before, but it's probably not Allstate Arena, and the vibe of the game certainly is not going to be as it would be.
Won't be as many people either.
In Allstate, well, there probably aren't going to be as many people.
Yep.
If they get over all that and legitimately play it like it's a road game, there's no reason for Chicago to win the game.
Exactly, exactly. Arizona travels to San Antonio. Should be, as I said, this is the game I was telling you about before, I mentioned before. I think this game's gonna be a lot different outcome than, the Utah game was this past Monday.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, you hate the short week for San Antonio. The good news is they're not traveling, but it's still a short week, you know, no less, and that's gonna make things it's gonna make things very difficult. And by the way, that makes things horrendously difficult on Utah mm-hmm. to have to travel, you know, to San Antonio, then back to Utah, and then over to Chicago in a span of just 5 days. There is no circumstance which you don't take Arizona in a game. There just isn't.
Earlier this year, Arizona dropped 83 on San Antonio in a 43-point shellacking.
I don't know if it's gonna be that bad this time around, but it's probably not gonna be very pretty either.
Yeah. One of the late games on Saturday is going to be Jacksonville traveling the country and meeting up in Spokane to play the Shock.
It's an interesting game, to say the least. I haven't been impressed with Jacksonville very much over the course of the last several weeks. I still think the team is, I don't want to say totally doing it with smoke and mirrors, but it kind of sort of feels like that's... You know, that's what the case is. The game in Orlando that they played a couple weeks ago was, it was a horribly ugly game.
Yeah.
Offense got it together against Pittsburgh last week, but again, it was Pittsburgh. This was a team that scored at least 61 points in its first four games and has only scored more than 55 once since that point. So I think Spokane's offense is going to have enough in this game. This is another one of those games if you're Utah, if you're Iowa, if you're San Antonio, you know, this could be the game that essentially puts Spokane in the playoffs and really just lets those three West teams all, I don't want to say clinch, but seemingly clinch their playoff spots to get in. I like Spokane in this game.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I know we talked about it before and with the crowd and the way that how crazy the fans are there. This is only the second time in their series that the game has actually been played in Spokane. Spokane played Jacksonville last year in April and beat them 56-48. So, but it's, yeah, I don't know. Ever since these are the two teams, the last teams in the AFL that were undefeated. They both went on losing streaks. Right now, the Shock is the better of the teams. For some reason, they've been able to rebound a lot more, a lot better than the Sharks have. And I think it'll show that just this week also. I think Spokane will win this game and they will continue their rise up in the Western Division and continue to hold on to that playoff spot. So last game of the week, and Adam, it's Pittsburgh traveling to San Jose I know there's really not much we can say about this. I think for me the question is who's going to be starting at quarterback for the San Jose SaberCats after McKnight went down last week. But there's one difference, Adam, between the Pittsburgh Power team that is playing this weekend than there was this Pittsburgh Power team that played 1 year ago on Saturday. What would that be?
They're actually bringing a team?
No.
They're actually
are playing a game. That is correct, sir. 1 year ago, this Saturday, will be the 1 year anniversary of the first ever forfeited game in Arena Football League history,
and we can all knock on wood together, will be the only forfeited game in AFL history.
Yes. It's funny, Cleveland is actually playing at home the same week. I didn't mention it before, but you know, they're playing on Friday, but they're actually playing at home the same week that they didn't play.
And maybe they'll show up this time.
Yeah. But I think it depends on who's going to start for, I think, you know, San Jose, our fans have them favored by 18 points in our pick 'em, our spread pick 'em.
They're not winning this game by 18 if Russ McKnight is not playing.
No, they won't, no.
But if Russ McKnight is playing, I could absolutely believe them winning this game by 40. You know, you look at Steven Sheffield, and last week he had one of the most vexing games of any quarterback over the course of the week. He went 24 of 30. That's pretty freaking awesome. Bernard Morris, who he was going against, only went 18 of 34. Threw for 235 yards, threw for 6 touchdowns. That's all great, but he also threw 2 picks. And you know, they lost 2 fumbles in the game. They ended up with the 4 turnovers. They lost the ball once on downs, and that's how you lose in the Arena Football League.
Yep.
You turn the ball over 5 times, you're not going to win too many games.
Nope.
You know, it's such an SOB road trip for Pittsburgh. I don't see them getting over the hump in this game. Really, I don't even see them winning this game even if Micah doesn't play.
No, I agree. Yeah, I think San Jose is a little bit shell-shocked from what happened to them last week. I mean, they got their asses handed to them on a platter. This is a team that's, you know, it usually does very, very well at home. And I think Pittsburgh's going to be the medicine that's going to make them feel all right. First of all, I want to say thank you very much for Jim Robson for joining us this week. A great interview. It was a very, very interesting pre-game, pre-show to the actual show itself, right, Adam? I mean, it's, as we mentioned before, very, very knowledgeable about the league, and we'd be happy to have him on the show, obviously, again. If there is anything you want to mention to us, comments, suggestions, you want to contact Adam, you know how to do so, but we'll let you know again, adam.markowitz@arenafan.com, and if you want to contact me, at tim.capper@arenafan.com. So, before we finish up, Adam, any last words, sir?
A happy 10-year reunion anniversary to everybody that I graduated high school with. We graduated Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Thursday at this time. We graduated 10 years ago. So, woo, go Lake Owl High School, class 2003.
Woo! I remember my 10th anniversary. That was
25 years ago, right?
That was almost 15 years ago. So yeah. So enjoy the games this week, everybody. Again, we'll be returning next week, most likely, and we're taping on Wednesday, but we'll let you just watch our social media accounts. So for everybody here at the AFL Tonight family, for Adam Markowitz, I'm Tim Capper. Watch the rebound off the net.